Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out how NASA is working with local water managers to revolutionize the way the state measures how much snow is in the Sierra. It could be a big boost to farmers and cities, as well as a help to people downstream who might be at risk for floods. We'll also talk with former Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen, who's now working in the world of philanthropy as CEO of the Central Valley Regional Foundation. We'll hear about her plans for that organization and also concerns that a popular chemical farmers use to get rid of weeds in their fields could be linked to increased risks of Parkinson's disease. We'll find out why research from UCLA into paraquat has focused on the valley and why the EU has already banned the herbicide, while its maker claims it's safe. We begin, though, with a look at the criminal justice system. California is in the middle of reversing decades of tough-on-crime policies. Realignment and Propositions 47 and 57 have been instituted to lighten the load in county jails and state prisons. Now lawmakers are examining a system that sometimes keeps people in jail before they've even been convicted. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports criminal justice reformers say California's use of cash bail has created an income-based justice system.
So here's how this works. Let's say you're arrested and charged with a crime, and you find yourself in the Fresno County Jail. Now you can get out, but the state wants some money to make sure you come back to court. That's where you need someone like bail bondsman Barry Perlstein, who owns Lucky Bail Bonds. He waits in his quiet, simple office a stone's throw from the county jail.
It's not anything close to what people see on TV or Dog the Bounty Hunter or otherwise. You know, that's just not really what it's all about.
There's a lengthy list of felonies and misdemeanors in California, and each one has a cash bail amount tied to it. The rates vary from county to county. But overall, California routinely has some of the highest in the country, averaging around $50,000. Pay a bondsman like Barry 10% of that amount, and he'll guarantee the court that you won't skip town. If you do, he'll probably show up on your doorstep complete with a black vest and badge marking him as an officer of the court.
We have radios, extra magazine pouches for the handguns we carry. Multiple pouches for handcuffs.
If he can't bring you to court in 6 months, he owes the court the entirety of your bond. Either way, he keeps the 10% fee. In exchange, you can be free to continue your life while your case plays out. Perlstein strongly defends the cash bail system as necessary, effective, and a constitutionally protected part of the criminal justice system.
What we do is important to the pretrial release system, whether you like bail or not, whether you believe that people are entitled to that or not. The Constitution provides for it, and there's a reason for that.
Perlstein says the bail system works because people have skin in the game and are more likely to return to court. He claims that 99% of people show up, although the state does not keep an official tally of the number of people who skip bail. But some call this system a de facto debtor's prison that keeps people who have not been convicted of a crime in prison because they're too poor to pay. One of the authors of a bill to replace the current system with one more lenient is Assemblymember Rob Bonta of Oakland. Bonta says he was shocked by the inequities in California's bail system after hearing stories about poor people arrested, but not convicted, who lost their jobs, kids, or car because they couldn't bail out.
So there are massive human impacts that are tied to this wealth-based system. We shouldn't have a wealth-based criminal justice system. You shouldn't have better outcomes if you have more money in your pocket.
Bonta's bill and a companion bill in the state Senate would not completely do away with cash bail. They would greatly reduce its use and allow more people to be released without bail if they're deemed not to be a flight risk or a threat to the public. In all, 15 states in Washington, D.C. have adopted a bail system that allows judges to set individual bail amounts based on perceived risk. Currently in California, it's set by a table and largely blind to individual circumstance. The state has been sued by a group called Equal Justice Under the Law, which opposes the cash bail system. They believe it violates the Constitution's promise of equal protection by favoring the wealthy. The group's CEO, Phil Telfian, says the women they are representing were never even convicted of any crime, but still suffered the consequence of arrest.
Both of our clients in litigation in San Francisco actually had their charges dismissed. One of them lost her job while she was in jail, pending trial, before her charges were dismissed, and the other was unable to take care of her grandmother.
Telfian says other places have largely replaced cash bail with a robust pretrial services agency that reminds people when and where they need to go to court. He argues that while taxpayers must pay for this model, it is cheaper than keeping someone in jail because they can't afford bail. However, in D.C., the pretrial services agency says only about 88% of people released without bail return for their court appearance. But it's not just people like Telfian who say it's time for change. Even strong law and order advocates like Barry Perlstein and Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims concede the bail rates have gotten out of control. But rather than get rid of it, Mims says fix it.
The methodology of how it happens is interesting. I think they should take into consideration poverty levels in the counties. There should be some kind of formula to figure out what a bail schedule should be.
And to be clear, cash bail is big business in California. Perlstein says he guarantees as much as $15 million a year in bonds. Bigger companies, he says, do work in the billions. Lowering the bail schedules would eat into revenue. Recall, they keep the 10% fee regardless of the outcome of the case. But it probably would not put them out of business, which is exactly what some activists say they want to do. The first hearing on the bills are expected in April. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. It's springtime in the Valley, which for many of us means it's time to clear the weeds out of our backyards. The same goes for growers. But the landscape of industrial weed killers is changing. A California judge recently ruled that the main ingredient of the popular herbicide Roundup must be labeled as a carcinogen. And as FM89's Kerry Klein reports, another popular herbicide is facing some scrutiny over its health impacts as well.
Weeds kill crops. Kurt Hembree says that's because they're pernicious moochers.
Direct competition for water and nutrients. Whatever the tree likes, the weeds like.
Hembree is a weed specialist with the UC Cooperative Extension in Fresno County.
That's our cheeseweed or a malva.
He advises growers on how to manage their weeds.
Typical winter. These are typical winter weeds.
We're standing in a field near Selma that's got rows and rows of leafy stalks about 2 feet tall.
This is a young almond orchard baby planting. They call them baby trees.
He says one product is especially good at protecting young trees from weeds, paraquat.
Well, paraquat's basically a contact-type herbicide. In other words, it's a material that if you sprayed it on a plant, you disrupt the plant cells.
He says it essentially melts away plant tissue, clearing the ground of any living plant other than the tree.
And basically in 5 or 6 days, it's whatever it touches, it spots up, it causes necrosis and death of the tissue.
Paraquat is popular because it's cheap and effective. But like many chemicals, it's dangerous. It's a highly controlled, lethal substance with strict instructions to keep handlers safe. Nonetheless, an emerging body of research suggests mere exposure to the chemical is correlated with increased risk of Parkinson's disease. Many countries have outlawed the herbicide, including the European Union, which banned it in 2007, partly because of uncertainty surrounding Parkinson's. As researchers work to tease out the nature of that correlation, paraquat remains one of the most common herbicides in California. To be clear, Hembree says paraquat is explicitly labeled as toxic.
There's different warning label levels. This is danger, which is the highest level you can have.
Swallowing even a small amount can lead to organ failure and death. It's occasionally used even for suicides, particularly in developing countries. To prevent accidental ingestion, it's dyed blue and given a sharp smell. It's typically sprayed by machine to minimize human contact.
You're going to wear, rubber boots. You're going to wear goggles while you're spraying. You're going to wear a helmet. You don't want to get the stuff on your skin, in your mouth, or anywhere.
Paraquat is among the top 10 most common herbicides in California, and the San Joaquin Valley gets over 3/4 of the state total. It's used on scores of crops, primarily tree nuts, grapes, alfalfa, and cotton. And before the drought struck, paraquat use was rising. In 2011, Valley growers used almost 80% more of it than they did in 1990, the earliest year data are available. Some researchers say those numbers are concerning.
The number of studies that have linked paraquat use occupationally to increased risk of Parkinson's should raise some concerns if there is an increasing environmental presence.
Dr. Caroline Tanner is a neurologist at UC San Francisco who's dedicated her career to studying Parkinson's disease. In 2011, she published a highly cited study based on in-depth surveys with agricultural workers in the Midwest.
People who mixed or applied this chemical had more than double the risk of developing Parkinson's disease compared to people really very similar as far as, you know, where they lived, even what they did for a living, age and gender.
Notably, Tanner says, people who said they were careful with personal protective equipment were an exception.
Those people, when exposed to paraquat, still didn't have a greater risk of Parkinson's.
Tanner is careful to call the Parkinson's-paraquat relationship a correlation, not causation. But it's one of many studies that suggests that correlation. And both Tanner and a co-author at the National Institutes of Health argue that's enough reason to raise alarm bells, even without evidence for cause and effect. Not all researchers are quite as convinced. Sarisha Nandapati is a neurologist with Kaiser Permanente in Marin County. She authored a review last year that compiled other studies of Parkinson's disease. Of the 8 studies she found that mentioned paraquat, 1 study demonstrated no connection between the two, and 3 others showed a correlation only when paraquat was combined with other risk factors.
So it seems like genetic factors can influence it. Even synergistic effects between paraquat and other pesticides can lead to some sort of correlation between paraquat and Parkinson's. But the data is certainly mixed.
Part of what's confounding is that Parkinson's disease is rare, and there's no statewide registry of its incidence. Plus, it's a long-term disease, and it may reflect environmental exposures from decades ago. In 2014, Tulare County had the highest rate of Parkinson's-related deaths in the Valley, but it wasn't a standout across the state. Plus, many other Valley counties apply more paraquat. Syngenta, the chemical giant that manufactures gramoxone, whose main ingredient is paraquat, declined an interview for this story, but did issue a statement claiming its product is not associated with the disease. It has also funded studies that conclude that. The EPA and CDC do not mention Parkinson's disease on their paraquat information pages, but the EPA does acknowledge the emerging research in a regulatory filing from March 2016. Meanwhile, ongoing research out of UCLA aims to pinpoint the environmental exposures associated with Parkinson's disease here in California. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. After 5 years of drought, there's so much snow in the Sierra Nevada that state water officials are preparing for a massive runoff year. But the traditional way of calculating the snowpack has a huge margin of error. And as Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports, a new way to measure it could greatly decrease that inconsistency.
Every winter and spring, a network of snow surveyors manually tally how much snow is in the Sierra Nevada. They do this by measuring snow depth in the same spots every year. Pacific Gas and Electric hydrographer Christine Borman and I hopped out of a helicopter in 2014 in the mountains east of Fresno to do this. As we snowshoe to a spot where snow levels have been recorded since 1928, she pierced the snow with a hollow aluminum tube.
And this seems pretty soft, so I'm going to let it go down pretty easily.
When she finished, she told me to record the measurements.
49, so 8 inches of water pressure.
Crews like Borman's either ski or fly in, but that could change with the use of new technology. A 4-year pilot project between NASA, the California Department of Water Resources, and local water authorities is measuring the snowpack from the sky. They're using planes that shoot out laser pulses to detect how deep the snowpack is and how much water is in it. It started out as a test project on the Tuolumne watershed 4 years ago and is now being used on the San Joaquin River watershed. Kat Borman is one of the NASA scientists based in Mammoth who work on the plane.
This one here is LIDAR. It has two laser sources situated within the unit itself. We can push out 800,000 points per second with this unit.
Those pulses bounce back to the unit and combined create a map of the area. The team flies the plane over the region when there's no snow, and then again at the start of each month from February to April. Subtract the first value from the second, and then voila, you have the snowpack depth. A second unit on the plane detects the snow density. Tom Painter is a NASA scientist who came up with the idea. He says to think of the old system of manual surveys like a computer screen with only a few pixels working.
Over 30 years of looking at those pixels turn on, you've put together a relationship as to what the actual picture is. But you don't ever actually know what the actual picture is. Whereas we're turning on every pixel on the screen.
Painter says this is a big deal because manual snow surveys can be off by 20 to 60%. In his past flyovers of the Tuolumne watershed, the new measurements were only about 2% off. He says the data also shows what snow will melt first, based on how dark it is.
And that allows us to do a very certain forecast of how much water is going to come out of the basins. That uncertainty that's been a part of water management in the western U.S. is going to go away.
The first set of data from the flyovers of the San Joaquin watershed from the beginning of February show there's just over 1.5 million acre feet of snow waiting to melt in the mountains east of Fresno. That's like 1.5 million football fields with a foot of water covering their entirety. That number is expected to greatly increase when data comes in from the March and April flyovers. Jeff Payne is the Water Resources and Operations Coordinator for the Fryant Water Authority in charge of the basin.
They found depths of 50 feet in some of the avalanche areas. If you can imagine 50 feet of snow, that's Donner Party depths. It's crazy. It's going to be really eye-opening for us, you know, start incorporating these things into our water supply management.
If using this technology proves to be as good as it sounds, Payne says its success has huge ramifications for California. Frank Gerke leads the California Cooperative Snow Program, collecting snowpack data. He says the precision that comes with using this technology may prove helpful for farms and cities in wet and dry years, because they might get a water supply forecast up to a month earlier than they do now.
You know, how much acreage you should plant, what you should grow, do you have to hook your wells up? And to the extent that there is uncertainty in a forecast, then the end user has to hedge their bets.
Gerke says the only problem the new technology poses is how expensive it is to operate. He says it can cost 3 times as much as the amount it costs for the manual surveys. The other benefit from the aerial surveys is precise knowledge about potential flooding. That's important to water managers like Michael Jackson, who oversees Fryant Dam for the Bureau of Reclamation. As we look at water spewing from the dam, he says he expects more than 4 million acre feet to flow out of Fryant Dam and down the San Joaquin River this spring. The reservoir only holds about 520,000 acre feet.
We'll probably end up needing to draw it down below 300,000 acre feet in order to make room for what's shaping up to be a record snowpack and runoff year.
For Jackson, knowing exactly how much water will flow into Millerton Lake northeast of Fresno is super important for protecting homes, farms, and levees from flooding.
The better information we have, the more certainty we can provide in our operations. Could even come down to a safety issue like this year with all the flood control parameters we're working with and trying to make sure we don't have to release too much water downstream.
As the new data continues to come in, the old way of snow surveying won't totally go away. For at least the coming years, water leaders will compare the data from the two methods to see if there are any inaccuracies. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and check in with former Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen. She has a new job as head of the Central Valley Community Foundation. We'll find out what she's doing in the world of philanthropy and what her vision is. That's coming up straight ahead. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Many thought former Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen would wind up in the world of politics, perhaps even making a run for the Republican nomination for governor. She threw political prognosticators a curveball, though, last year when she announced that after she left office, she would take a role as the CEO of the Central Valley Community Foundation. So what's a politician doing leading a philanthropic organization? And what's her vision for the group formerly known as the Fresno Regional Foundation? A few days ago, I sat down with her at her office to find out where her organization is headed.
Ashley Swearingen, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You could have chosen just about anything to do after you left City Hall. Politics is certainly something a lot of people thought you might do, but you chose the world of philanthropy. Why moving into this realm instead of something else, either the private sector business world or some other political role?
Well, I am so excited to be here at the Central Valley Community Foundation, and folks who know me and what I did before I was mayor, what I did for 8 years as mayor, understand that continuing that focus on the Central Valley and really lifting up and improving Fresno and the Central Valley, it's what I've been doing now for 20 years. So I couldn't imagine not being involved with things that help improve the quality of life for the people who live in this place, attracting investment, and doing everything we can from a philanthropy standpoint to really continue the mission of community transformation. And CVCF is all about that. So it's really the perfect opportunity for the work I wanted to continue to do.
Before you came here, the foundation saw its programs and scope expand greatly. It changed its name from the Fresno Regional Foundation to expand to a broader San Joaquin Valley mission. How do you see the foundation's mission and activities evolving and growing now that you're here?
Well, obviously, we are all about being effective with philanthropic resources and making sure our communities are strengthened. And so there are a lot of ways in which we'll go about doing that here at CVCF. We did expand the footprint last year to a 6-county area. Over the next couple of years, we'll be working more closely with people in the surrounding counties and really just getting in touch with them, what's important to them, how we can support them here from the foundation. They don't have community foundations in their counties, and so that's why it was important for the Central Valley Community Foundation to take the surrounding area under its wing and provide that support from a community foundation standpoint. But it's all about helping local people identify their priorities, help them assemble resources to accomplish the things that are going to make a difference in their communities. And we're really here just to help with that process, help raise money to the best of our ability, and help make sure that those communities are strengthened. And then, of course, in Fresno, I imagine that we'll continue to focus heavily on things related to skill building, education, workforce development, career pathways, giving our kids among the youngest from newborns all the way through the early career days, making sure there's a clear path for them to be successful here in the greater Fresno region. So that work around the people of Fresno and the Central Valley will be very important to us. But we're also going to focus a lot on the quality of the place that we have here too, and make sure that our cities, our rural areas, our parks, all of the things that make our region beautiful continue to be beautiful, and that we have the resources to really positively impact the environment as well.
As a leader of the foundation, you're in charge of managing around $50 million or more of assets, donor-advised funds, all sorts of things. You work with larger foundation partners as well as individual members of the community. How do you see that relationship evolving, working with individuals here in the Valley? Maybe they're looking at for estate planning or other tax planning issues versus larger out-of-town foundations who want to make an impact here in the San Joaquin Valley and come to you and say, where can we have our biggest footprint?
Well, we are really all about bringing people and investors together here at CVCF to make greater impact in this area. So we'll have, for example, small dollar donors who will approach us and say, I'd really like to give this $10,000 or $5,000 gift to this particular initiative. Could you help me match that money? And we've already had some success in the last few weeks in just raising the profile of opportunities to leverage dollars like that. We've got a few initiatives we'll be rolling out in the next few weeks that are very much in that same sort of spirit. And the same is true for external foundations. I mean, I think large state and national foundations want to be effective on the ground in Fresno and in the Central Valley, but they're looking for a partner who can help make sure their dollars are best used. And so I think we'll be quite successful in attracting those outside resources, particularly when we commit to matching their funds. I mean, if, you know, if a large external foundation came to us and said, listen, we really want to make a great impact in Fresno, we'll pay for half. Could you come up with the other half? I mean, that's a challenge we would love to accept on behalf of the greater Fresno area. So really kind of bringing those resources together and guiding them in a fashion that gets the best benefit for the folks on the ground in our region is what Central Valley Community Foundation is all about.
Oftentimes when people talk about this area, especially from outside, the talk is about poverty, but there's also great wealth here. How do you try to tap into that and build those relationships with those individuals who do have the means to make a difference?
What I have found over the years, and I've been doing community and economic development for almost 20 years in the Valley now, solid plans attract financial resources. And I think many of the donors who certainly have huge hearts for the places where they live, they love this place and in many ways are already contributing to the, you know, in ways that they can. But sometimes they're frustrated that they feel like the money they give doesn't seem to actually make a difference. So I think our opportunity here at the Central Valley Community Foundation is to knit together the strategic initiatives, get all of the team on board, whether they be public agencies, civic leaders, nonprofits, et cetera, and really build efforts and initiatives that will absolutely make a difference. When we get to that point, it won't be too difficult to attract the financial resources. So I think just kind of being in that middle space and raising the issues, but also helping to craft the solutions that can attract the dollars from the donors, I think is a big role for CVCF.
In the last couple of years before you came to the foundation not only expanded its scope in terms of geography, but also its budget. Staffing went up. The square footage you occupy significantly increased, more than doubled. How do you see the challenges of trying to maintain the effectiveness out there with the things that you're doing in terms of investments and leveraging resources versus trying to run the operation? Do you see continued growth? Where do you see the foundation going operationally?
Well, we are extremely busy here at CVCF, and the expansion that happened this last year, I think ultimately is going to serve the Central Valley very well. Just as an example, we're here in the Center for Community, which is an incredible conference and meeting space that's available at no cost to community partners and nonprofits who need to come here and use it for any number of reasons. We see literally hundreds and hundreds of organizations using our facilities every year and thousands of people coming through these doors, coming together, working on their initiatives, working on the things that they believe is going to make their communities better. So I actually am very pleased to see the expansion of the foundation. It's a lot of work to keep up what is here today. But at the same time, I think as we start to focus our efforts and we can demonstrate we're really getting good outcomes for our donors, I think it's going to be nothing but up from here for the Central Valley Community Foundation. We're already seeing a lot of interest and excitement around what's happening here. And I'm grateful for the last 51 years of this place. The history of this place is really remarkable, and we just want to build on that.
A lot of donors are very passionate about their own interests and have personal connections in some way, a passion about a particular issue. And you, as a leader of the foundation, you've laid out a very passionate case for certain things that you'd like to see the foundation focus on. How do you balance those two? Because maybe a donor is very interested in protecting riverlands or something like that, and your priorities are something else. How do you go about navigating that? Because you have donor-advised funds and things like that where the donor has a large say. How do you balance those?
Well, first and foremost, here at the Central Valley Community Foundation, we are all about increasing philanthropy in this city and in this region. And so we really don't necessarily need to be too particular about how a donor chooses to give their money. I mean, we're excited when people choose to give back, period. We love that. There's something special that happens when a person gives. And when they give freely, I mean, it is a transforming thing to see people give their resources and do the things that they're passionate about. So we support that here at CVCF. That's what we're all about, number one. Number two, we know that over time, our donors are going to want support for figuring out how to best leverage their dollars. And so, you know, if a donor wants to make a donation to a particular organization they're close to, we are here for them. We support making sure that that happens. But a lot of people are starting to come to us and say, hey, I don't really know where I want to give this money, but I know I want to affect kids positively. How would you recommend that we give our money? So we're very excited to have those conversations. And then even taking it a step further, we love when donors come in and say, well, look, I'll do half, but can you go find the other money? So we love those challenges. And we think as we get better at facilitating that sort of grant making, we'll see more and more people just getting involved in philanthropy. And honestly, you know, when people, we're going to start a bunch of initiatives that engage small dollar donors as well. When people give $5 or $10 to something, people come together, that lifts a community in a way that is almost more important than the dollars themselves. So we want to facilitate that for our community.
Back when you were at City Hall, you'd often talk about how Fresno's on the national radar of a lot of different groups, public policy groups, in some cases also philanthropy groups. What do they look for in Fresno, aside just from impact? We've talked about that. And how do you try to get us on the radar of some more of those large international or at least national foundations that are out there that have money to invest?
Well, they look for communities that are being honest about themselves and their challenges and that are earnestly working together to address those challenges. And they look at things like, are the institutional leaders coming together and crafting shared plans? Are the private business leaders and nonprofit community lining up with, they look for unity, they look for strong collaboration, and they look for people who are making an effort to change their communities with or without outside help. And the more we understand in Fresno and the Central Valley that there is no rescuer, there is no savior, we have to do the work ourselves, we have to put the solutions together, we have to do our best to raise those dollars locally to affect the change that we want to see. When we take that responsibility and we're actually dealing with root issues, that's the very point at which outside funders want to come in and help. So it turns out, you know, the work that's important anyway, just when you decide, okay, nobody else is going to come help us, let's just figure it out ourselves, that is, in fact, the point at which people want to get involved and support what you're doing because they see that honest effort. And I think we're definitely there in Fresno. I think the next decade we're going to see many of the plans that have been laid, good, solid, innovative plans that are backed up with local dollars, local resources, that's going to attract external investors is my firm belief.
Do you miss being mayor?
I don't miss being mayor because I know we have a great mayor. And I'm so excited to see what Mayor Brand and his team are doing. And I was so happy to hand off to him and know that things were in good hands. And we are so fulfilled here at the Central Valley Community Foundation with what we're trying to do. It's, as I mentioned before, it's much of the same work, just coming at it with different tools and a different approach. But we're still, you know, still Team Central Valley here and working to make our region a better place.
Former Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen is now the CEO of the Central Valley Community Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Valley Public Radio. I'm Joe Moore. Last week, the Public Policy Institute of California released a new report documenting the challenges the San Joaquin Valley faces when it comes to water. water stress and a changing San Joaquin Valley. We have one of the report's authors joining us right now. Ellen Hanick is the director of the PPIC Water Policy Center and a senior fellow with PPIC. Ellen, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
And in fact, going on right now in Clovis, the PPIC Water Policy Center and the California Water Institute at Fresno State, they're holding a free half-day public event featuring panels of local leaders and experts to discuss key water issues facing the valley. And you can see the webcast of that event live at ppic.org. Ellen, I want to start out before we get to the report itself, but just the issue that's probably on most people's minds right now. We've had so much rain, so much snow. What does this really mean in terms of the long-term outlook for this part of the region? Is it just a blip on the radar, or is it something that signals something larger?
Well, what it reminds us of is that we have a very variable climate in California. That's true in the valley, and that's true statewide. And what we're seeing with the changing patterns in our climate is that it's getting even more variable. So the wet years are often getting wetter, and the dry years are getting hotter, and that makes them drier. So what's really key in years like this is being able to capture as much of the flood flows as possible and get that water into the ground so that we have it for the drier years.
You talk about a changing San Joaquin Valley. Climate change is certainly part of that, but that's not all of the changes that you talk about in your report. What else are you referring to there?
Well, so one of the big changes that's on a lot of people's minds now in the valley is that folks have started to roll up their sleeves to implement a new state groundwater law that was enacted in the fall of 2014. And what that law calls for local water users in all of California's key groundwater basins to develop plans for managing that resource sustainably for the long term. And that's been a big issue. Probably the San Joaquin Valley is the place that is going to be hardest, most impacted by that change, because many parts of the region have been relying for over many decades on pumping more groundwater out of the ground than is being recharged naturally. So it's led to what we call overdraft, and it's leading to wells going dry, it's leading to land sinking, and various other problems that now folks are going to have to address in a sustainable way.
How should California look at groundwater? I hear a lot of people say that groundwater, even people in agriculture, say it's an insurance policy, essentially, for a farmer or a water user, whether it's a city or anyone else, who may have their surface supplies up and down. Given the type of water year that we're having, groundwater is an insurance policy. Is that a wise way to look at it, or is it maybe something we need to look at differently?
I think actually that's the perfect way to look at it. It's kind of our buffer, really, because it is more flexible than our surface water. You know, we use both surface water and groundwater in California, and the proportions vary by local area and by region. But what you see in a place like the San Joaquin Valley, which has a lot of groundwater reserves in addition to using a lot of surface water, is that groundwater becomes especially important during droughts when the surface water supplies are more limited. And you could see this during this most recent drought in 2015, which was, you know, right at the height of the drought. The farmers in the San Joaquin Valley got only about half of the surface water that they normally they would get in a sort of normal rainfall year. And yet they were able to pump extra groundwater, and as a result, their net shortfall in water was only about 10%. So that meant that groundwater really enabled them to limit the losses that they would have otherwise sustained because of the drought. Now, the key is making sure that during the normal years and during the wet years, you are getting as much water back into the ground as possible. And the problem in many parts of the valley is that there have only been a few years where there's been net recharge. We've kind of been drawing down the bank even in the normal and wet years in many places. So there's a danger of just that long-term buffer and insurance policy going away if we don't start managing it better.
One of the big things that's on the table right now in California is the proposal to build two tunnels under the Delta to allow water exports from Northern California to move south, bypassing that sensitive ecological region. Does your proposal look at that, and how would that impact groundwater issues in the San Joaquin Valley? Do you get into that issue?
So in this report, we sort of tee up a menu of strategies and tools that folks in the valley and their partners in the state can consider in terms of how to bring supplies and demands into balance. And definitely some of these big infrastructure investments are options on the table, just like more sort of smaller scale projects like groundwater recharge in various agricultural areas. So there are a lot of different items on the menu. The Twin Tunnels project that has been under consideration now for about a decade and is, you know, getting to the point of final environmental review, that could be an important tool for the Valley to address its water supply and demand imbalance, because right now the Valley depends quite a bit on imports of water from Northern California to as a regular water supply. We looked at over the last 30 years the water balance for the valley and found that a full quarter of the water used in the valley was coming through those pumps in the South Delta. And that is a source that is less and less reliable now because of just deteriorating environmental conditions in the Delta that have led in recent years to some restrictions on pumping. And the proposal, the Twin Tunnel proposal, is a way to basically shore up the reliability of those supplies. What it also potentially does for the Valley is make it possible for the Valley to benefit from storage investments in Northern California, which is wetter and which has more potential to capture additional water and store it in wet years. And if you can move that water through the Delta to the Valley, that can be a helpful way to contribute to resolving the supply-demand imbalance in the Valley.
You talk about infrastructure, and when it comes to groundwater, recharge is key. Do we have an idea of how much maybe potential there is for more types of projects like that would, in a year such as this one, where we're having exceptionally high flood releases and things like that, maybe try to capture some of that water and use that for recharge? Do we have enough infrastructure in the right places right now? And do we know where there might be some opportunities to build that in the future?
Well, so groundwater recharge is something that often can be done with small changes in infrastructure. If you think about how we recharge groundwater, you know, there are some places that have what are called dedicated recharge basins. Those are places that are just really good at getting water into the ground, where the soils are just perfect for it. And so you've got some places that where that's what the land does. It's just when there's water, the water goes there and sits and goes down into the ground. You also have a lot of recharge that happens on agricultural fields. And, you know, the valley is a major agricultural area, about 5 million acres of irrigated cropland. And a lot of that land is pretty good for recharge, too. So, you know, that's happened naturally over time just as part of the irrigation process in a lot of places. The extra water that plants don't use, a lot of that goes down into the groundwater basins. But now what folks are looking at is how do you amp that up when you've got a lot of water available? So looking at, you know, possibilities during the winter and spring to spread water on fields that are especially suitable for recharge. And you've seen experiments like that all over the valley this winter where, you know, even people are experimenting with putting pretty high amounts of water on some tree crop acreage, like on almond acres and on vineyards, because people are realizing that the crops can, the trees can take that. Some of these crops can take that during the winter and spring. Alfalfa is another really good crop for recharging groundwater. So I think the challenge now is sort of identifying all those good spots and the good places to do it and making sure that you've got the local infrastructure capabilities to get that water onto the fields. And often you do have it because of the irrigation systems that are there. In some cases, it's going to require a bit of tweaking, and some small local infrastructure investments. But it's quicker to implement that kind of thing than some of the big infrastructure projects like either the tunnels or new surface reservoirs.
We've been talking with Ellen Hanick. She is with the Public Policy Institute of California, the PPIC Water Policy Center, and the California Water Institute at Fresno State are holding a free half-day public event, in fact, going on right now in Clovis, and it's also available online at ppic.org, talking about this new report, Water Stress and a Changing San Joaquin Valley. Ellen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This is Valley Edition. There are a lot of efforts across the country to get kids to eat healthy foods. One great example can be found in Bakersfield, right off of Panama Lane at Buena Vista Elementary School. It's the home of the Buena Vista Edible Schoolyard, and it's a collaboration between the Panama-Buena Vista School District and the Grimm Family Foundation. Joining us now on the phone, we have Dylan Wilson. He's an assistant garden teacher at the Buena Vista Edible Schoolyard. They've got some events coming up for the public and more. Dylan, welcome to Valley Edition.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me today. How are you?
Doing very well. Let's start out with this, the basic question of what exactly are we talking about when we say an edible schoolyard? This is more than just the playing fields out on the soccer fields or something like that. We're actually talking about a garden, but it's more than that.
Yeah, it's more than that. So an edible schoolyard is definitely more than just a playground. This is a place where the students from Buena Vista Elementary come and they learn about how to garden and how to grow vegetables, and then in our kitchen, we teach them how to cook those vegetables and cook those foods and to live a healthy lifestyle and to eat healthy. And we're modeled after Alice Waters' edible schoolyard up in Berkeley. She's a proponent of the farm-to-table movement and the edible education system, which is a new kind of trend coming throughout the country. And we are trying to model that as best as we can.
So I want to talk about the curriculum in a second and how students are involved, but paint us a picture. Since this is radio, we don't have the benefit of seeing the great pictures on your website, but what does the schoolyard look like right now?
So the schoolyard right now, we're on an acre. We have five different growing areas, and then an orchard, full orchard, a full vineyard. And in each of these growing areas, we have production beds where we have leafy greens, carrots, root vegetables. We've got all of our winter crops in right now that are starting to come out as we're changing seasons, but it's a lot of green. We're seeing a lot of tree growth right now as everything's coming out of their dormancy. We've got a greenhouse, and then we've got about 12 chickens in the back that keep us busy with eggs and good compost material.
Sounds like you've got quite an operation there. How are kids involved in the schoolyard itself? And then we'll get to the curriculum.
So the kids are involved by doing a lot of the garden work that are assisting us in the garden work. And so right now I'm looking out on the garden. We have a third grade class in the garden, and in the back they're planting up for our plant sale that's going to be coming up here in a month. And then we've also got kids cultivating in a production bed. And then underneath one of our awnings, we've got students learning about pollination and pollinating, basically the basics of pollination with the pollinators and what they're doing with the flowers making fruit. So when they're here, they're fully integrated into our working system where they're doing a little bit of labor and, you know, learning how to work with the soil and how to do it themselves rather than just learning it out of a book. And then in the pollination section that they have going right now, they're actually learning the fundamentals of how the garden works.
So this is all integrated with the regular elementary curriculum, it sounds like.
It's not so – we try to match it as best as we can, but we do not match it one-on-one. This is just because we do have our own curriculum that we've created, but we do base it off what they're learning in the classroom. So right now in third grade, we're kind of reflecting that, not so much – one-on-one, but as I said, we just kind of try and go with it just to keep them up to pace.
And I understand there's a kitchen component to this also.
Yeah, kitchen component is super cool, super unique. We've got three cooking stations. We split them up into three groups. They make an entire dish out of out of what came out of the garden, and they're learning the basics of cooking and, you know, learning about herbs and spices and heat and all of the scientific processes behind it, and also learning just about flavors and the simple basics of cooking that a lot of kids don't get.
How do the kids like this?
Kids love it. This is such a unique experience for them, and they love coming to the garden because it's a way to get out of the normal classroom environment. They're outside, and especially on a beautiful day like today, they get to spend a little bit more time outside than they normally would on their recess.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Now, I understand you have this garden at Buena Vista Elementary, but there's also gardens in Shafter and Arvin as well?
Yeah, so we're collaborated with the Grimm Family Education Foundation, which brought up the Grimway Academy in Arvin, which is now under Grimway Schools. And then Grimway Arvin has a 1-acre garden, and they do the same thing that we do, mirroring our image. And then Grimway Academy Shafter is just starting. They just started construction. Our groundbreaking was 2 weeks ago, and they're going to have a garden program in that school as well.
Well, it's really appropriate considering the rich agricultural heritage of this part of the state. Now, you have some events coming up, both one on April 1st for the public and also a camp. In fact, a couple of camps. Tell us about those. We've got about a couple minutes left, so tell us what's coming up for the public.
So coming up, we have the first thing that'll be coming is our annual plant sale. This is our fourth annual plant sale. It'll be Saturday, April 1st from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. This is the only day that we open it up to the entire community. We're going to be selling plants that the kids have planted and that we've started in our own greenhouse. We're going to be selling those as a fundraiser for the program, and it's going to be able to help the community start their spring garden. We're going to have raffle prizes from local vendors. We'll have pizza baking out of our wood fire pizza oven, and a few other goodies and treats that we'll be selling out of our kitchen. And it's just a fun day to come get a garden tour and see what we have to offer and see what we're doing here and promote what we're doing.
Now, you also have a spring break camp and a summer camp. How can people learn more about that?
Yeah, so spring break camp and summer camp. Summer camp, I know, is filled up. That is a hot ticket item. That's a 2-week camp that we offer during the summertime. Enrollment usually comes around January or February. But the one coming up right after, a week after the plant sale, is the spring break camp from April 10th to April 14th. And that'll be in the morning from 8:30 to 12:30. And you can find out more about that at esykerncounty.org/springbreak. That'll be registration to open in February, but I hear that there might still be some spots.
Well, it sounds like a great opportunity for parents who want to get their kids some outdoor experience in a fun environment. Again, Dylan Wilson with the Buena Vista Edible Schoolyard Project in Bakersfield and the Grimm Family Foundation. Dylan, thank you so much.
Joe, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Likewise. That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you have to say. Send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or tweet us. We are @KVPR and @Valley Edition. Find our podcast and audio archives online at kvpr.org, and listen to our podcast on NPR One as well. Download the app at the App Store or Google Play. Again, for Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.